I mean, I think the biggest thing here that what makes this industry so hard to change is structurally we're set up a certain way. And we do have to evolve. The consumer is drinking, but they want you to be consistent with their values. They're not going to downgrade.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Sometimes even the best journalists get things wrong. And that thought consoles me when I get things really, really wrong, as I did when I was researching my next guest. Marion Leitner-Waldman is the founder of Archer Roos, the hit wine brand which offers wines in cans and bag-in-box in the US market. In one of her earlier interviews, Marion told a journalist that she'd begun Archer Roos because she wanted to democratize wine. Now, that's a phrase that makes my heart sink. I've heard it so many times before. And what it usually signals is that somebody is sourcing bulk wine on the open market that they're sticking in pretty packaging and selling at a premium. I could not have been more wrong. The first sign was when I told a wine colleague of mine that I was going to interview her, and he said she was one of the most brilliant people he'd ever met. The second sign came about 2 minutes into our conversation. Marion is absolutely not sourcing crappy bulk wine and palming it off as wine liberation. She's as serious a person as I have interviewed. She knows what she's doing and she cares passionately about quality. In an age where everything seems to be getting more expensive but worse, it was really inspiring to talk to someone who stands for integrity. And Marion has such an optimistic view of wine, and she has the results to back it, which makes this a must-listen for anybody involved in the wine market. As always, the takeaways will be in the newsletter, which you can sign up for at drinksinsider.com. Marion, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here, Felicity. Thanks for having me.
Right. Now, just before we started, you were telling me about cinemas, that you've actually got distribution in cinemas. How's that going?
Honestly, it's going better than I could have ever imagined. We're seeing double-digit velocity on a monthly basis per cinema, which it's just astounding. And I think it really speaks to the fact that, you know, one, we all learned to drink wine while watching movies while we were at home during the pandemic, and we're taking that behavior into these movie theaters. But what's more, we're all looking for that communal experience again in sharing in that theater experience. And that's just so exciting to
me. That is so interesting. Do you have any data about how people are drinking? Like, do you know that it came out of pandemic behavior, or is that just an educated guess?
Well, it was actually the reason why Regal Cinemas approached us during this RFP, was when they were thinking about how do they get more butts back into seats. They were asking people what was preventing them from going into the movies and, you know, getting up from their couch. And the response was, well, I can drink my really great wine at home. And so that then became a priority for Regal Cinemas, was making sure that they could get adult beverages at the theater.
That is fantastic. Now, are you competing with RTDs, or are people in a civilized manner just choosing wine over other things?
Well, I think that there's like a slight differentiation for how I would love to characterize that question.
Okay.
Which is that I really view this strategy as we are, rather than the typical wine industry of really asking the consumer to conform to expectations we already have around how to drink it, our strategy is very much about where are our consumers and wine drinkers already spending their time and how do we meet them there. So I think we're just unlocking the wine drinkers that were always there.
That is fantastic. Now, do you have any insight into which movies mean the most wine consumption?
You know, not yet, but now that you've asked me that question, I'm going to dig a little bit more
into that. I really want to know. I want to know if like horror movies mean like double cans, or
yeah, anything that like causes a lot of anxiety, all of a sudden you're double fisting. I mean, I'm very curious too.
Yeah, exactly. All right, now you also distribute Archer Roos into other unusual places like arcades. Tell me about that.
You know, again, like I think as a society, and particularly, you know, everyone likes to think about millennials and Gen Zers as like young kids, where we all basically have kids, you know, millennials have kids themselves and mortgages and day jobs, and Gen Zers are in their 20s now. And I think there's just this bigger shift as a society in how we parent and how we spend our leisure time. And so again, this comes back to this strategy of like, hey, people are spending a lot more time with their families as a whole in quality time. That's a major value. So then how do we show up where they're spending time with their families? And part of that is at an arcade.
That's fantastic. Yeah, talking about generations, I mean, you know, speaking as a member of Gen X, I still believe that I'm like the Douglas Copeland era, where the hot young things, and it turns out it's not true. But you're also...
Well, Felicity, that gives me hope, because in my mind, I'm still stuck in my awkward teen years. So if you get to be cool as a bright young thing, fabulous.
Yeah, thank you so much for saying that. And you're also in stadiums as well. How did you get the brand into these places?
Well, it actually started, it was really a hand-to-hand combat. We really started in just, frankly, like I went to a Taylor Swift concert and I noticed that there was one outlet in the entire stadium that sold wine. And that outlet literally had a line that was wrapped around the entire stadium. And the wine wasn't even good. Like I stood in that line and then I got there and I was like, oh my God, I'm drinking like garbage fire stuff over here. But it gave me this idea that like, what if I went to a concessionaire just at one stadium and I said, how much money are you making from beer? How much money are you making from spirits? How much money are you making for wine? And they told me, oh, well, wine is negligible. It's less than 1%. I said, great. I'd like just a test, you know, just for 3 concerts where you offer wine in all of your standard locations. And let's see if the profitability of your concessions go up overall. Because my hypothesis was that there were a lot of wine drinkers that were going to these events that didn't like the offerings and so weren't spending money, or maybe tried something but then only bought one. And literally at the end of the initial three tests, I saw a 15% increase in their bottom line, and so they gave me a bigger shot. And over time, we have built this step by step, stadium by stadium, and now on average, with very little marketing, we're outselling our competitors by like 5x in a stadium. And it's just about quality on.
This speaks to a very, very interesting point about the supposed abandonment of wine by younger people. And actually, if you look at the distribution channels are pretty much locked up with the very types of products that younger people don't like, you know, the heavily sugared, very commercial wines that sort of brought baby boomers into the market. Do you think that's an accurate idea, that maybe if the products were more interesting, the sales would be better?
Felicity, we're simpatico here. I mean, the wine industry has been navel gazing for the last 20 years about how to get young people to drink, and yet we ignore what other generations have wanted to drink. They want the same things that they're reaching for in the grocery aisle. They want transparency. They want high quality. They want premium products that tell a story, and they want it in a format that makes sense for them. 750 milliliter bottles are great for bottle aging, but they make no sense for 97% of occasions out there today, where it needs to be about getting to control how much you want to drink, aka moderation, and also making sense for the operator so they can turn a profit. And as long as you can offer a great quality product there, so it's a replacement pour for a bottle, we need to get smarter as an industry about serving that end consumer. Because frankly, yeah, most of them think wine is cool. They just think that the industry doesn't want them.
Interesting. I forgot to ask, the stadiums that you served in, did you start serving at Taylor Swift concerts? Or
oh, damn, no. That's my freaking ultimate goal. But we're getting there. Now, we just won a pretty big contract where inevitably it's now going to touch her stadiums. But sadly, I don't actually have a Taylor Swift concert.
Well, you've got to have a goal. You've got to have a goal. All right. Let's go right back to the beginning, because it's a fascinating origin story. So what I've read, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, that first of all, you used to work at the World Bank, and that you were sitting around the table with the founders of Warby Parker, and then you came up with the idea of building the wine brand. Are all of those things true?
Well, it wasn't necessarily the founder of Warby Parker. My friend, my buddy worked for the founder of Warby Parker, but yes, and I'm wearing a pair of Warby Parker glasses right now. I'm a huge fan of their brand, and they're a Hopkins alum, which was my university. But yeah, that is the origin of the story. We just wanted to have a better glass of wine. We I had a business trip early the next day, and I didn't want to open up a bottle because I was afraid I'd either drink it all or it was just going to go to waste in my fridge. And I just asked myself, one, why do serving sizes still come in this format in wine? And two, in the brands that have adjusted their formats, they're not brands that share my values. And yeah, frankly, shopping in the wine aisle, even for somebody who is pretty knowledgeable in wine, is still pretty frustrating. So how could I build a brand that stood for a set of values that, or I could then connect to my target consumer, and no matter where they were, as long as I showed up, they knew that I'd always offer them a high quality, transparent, low intervention made glass of wine. And that's the goal here.
So what was your wine background? I mean, how much did you drink wine? How much did you know about wine?
I drank a lot of wine. Yeah, I was, but I really can only say that I was a drinker, really. I had lived with a winemaker and a, you know, when I was in Spain as a legal drinking aged person, of course.
Nice catch.
Yes. And I really, that started a love affair with wine. So I was like this weirdo college kid that was like throwing dinner parties with wine. I literally founded a separate company just because like I wanted to throw parties with wine. And then I met my husband who'd been in the wine industry. And, you know, frankly, like even on a limited budget, we really started experimenting with higher and higher quality wines and finer wines and investing in futures and all these things. But I wasn't formally trained. And to me, when I look at the wine industry, and even when I look at my job today, so much of what I think about is I want to partner with really smart people who are excellent winemakers, but I don't want to be guided by my own ego. I want to understand what my consumer wants to drink and how do I bring that to her.
Okay, let's go back a step. What were you doing at the World Bank?
So I was actually working for the education unit. It was called the Global Partnership for Education, and we were dedicated to expanding access to education in the developing world.
Okay, so how do you go from that to being entrepreneurial? You said you started a company that was doing events. How did those things link up?
Gosh, I mean, sometimes like entrepreneurs, like we're wackadoodles. We're half naive, half just like crazy anarchic individuals. And I think in a lot of ways I'm no different. It's kind of hard to really paint a bigger picture without going back to like my personal origin story. But let's just suffice to say is that I've always been really passionate about stories and things that bring people together around connection, whether it's stories and literature itself, whether it's a glass of wine and food. But then the other piece that I've always loved is, and relates back to my background at the bank, was that I've always been involved with public-private partnerships. So how do you take bigger world problems and actually put them in the hands of like individuals or private companies to try to figure out how we can bring solutions to them? And so much of Archerousse is about that. One, wine is inherently about bringing people together. It's inherently about forging that connection with others or with yourself. I like to joke that, you know, a wine glass is kind of like an hourglass. And so it's nice. This time that you're committing to someone else. But at the same time, also in embracing alternative packaging, we're using the power of consumers' wallets to help enact systemic change, because 60% of the industry's carbon footprint comes from packaging and supply chain. So we can drink our way to a cleaner planet. And that's kind of how it all hangs together loosely. But the honest and personal answer is that my mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's. It caused a massive personal crisis. I was asking myself a lot of really big, deep existential questions. And I kind of just came down to like, if I personally only had 30 good years left on this planet, how did I want to spend it? And I knew that I just really enjoyed talking to people and I enjoyed bringing people together. And to me, that's what wine was about. And so that's kind of how I threw myself into this business. It makes no sense, Felicity, on paper, but that's how I got here.
I mean, this is the industry for that kind of thinking. I'm sure you've met lots of people along the way who have all sorts of wild and crazy and romantic.
Yes, fellow wackadoodles.
Yeah, well, yes. I was going to say romantic, but wackadoodle will do. Okay, but speaking of crazy and romantic, did you understand at the time that you started how incredibly difficult the three-tier system is in the US to get past? Did you have any idea of what you were going to face?
I had, well, My husband had imported wine from the Republic of Georgia back when natural wine was not a thing. So I had an idea of the gatekeeping system that was a three-tiered system. But I thought the hardest part was getting a distributor. I didn't understand that the hardest part is really managing and not just managing the distributor itself, but really building a marketing apparatus that allowed you to communicate with really what are three distinct customer groups, that distributor, that retailer, and that consumer, and making sure that your messaging was tailored but consistent across channels. I was naive in thinking that if I really stoked end consumer demand, then that throughput would naturally occur. And as you know, that's just not the case. That's not the way this industry works.
So I understand that you found help through beer distributors. Can you tell that story?
Absolutely. Well, you know, the one thing about the wine industry is that, you know, I think we struggle with change. And I came up in this business in an interesting time when beer was stagnating and beginning to decline. And so what I realized was that consumers were spending a ton of time in more traditional beer accounts. Like, think about this as like street food places, like taco joints, pizzerias, right. Active entertainment, like that's like axe throwing, bowling, arcades, and there were no wine options there, but there were beer accounts. And there was beer. And the other thing I realized was that as I was getting to know these operators and sort of trying to figure out our go-to-market strategy, that the beer distributor is actually usually the first person you call. Because whether we want to acknowledge or not, you have to get your kegerator installed. And that's usually a partnership of some sort. So the beer distributor is into these accounts super early. So I thought, man, I could cut the line. I could get into these accounts that, frankly, wine distributors weren't really paying attention to. And I also had an opportunity to provide incremental revenue to a distributor who was not, you know, delivering wine at that time. And so I really thought that it was super easy. I was going to be make that. That was it. I could now sail into the sunset. And of course, that's not exactly what happened, but it's definitely been an incredible piece of the story.
Well, of course, beer people know about cans, but when you first spoke to your first beer person, you said, "Hello, I've got wine in cans." How did they respond?
Actually, like very positively. Like, wine distributors really struggled with the concept, but beer distributors kind of got it. From the onset, like they were looking, they knew they had these captive consumers and they knew they wanted to unlock more revenue and opportunities within them. But the thing that they sort of struggled with was, yes, I know how to sell cans and I know the use case for this. And in fact, wine distributors immediately thought of this product as a off-premise offering. Beer distributors understood from the get-go that this was a great on-premise opportunity. And in fact, Felicity, 80% of my business today is on-premise, which is shocking still. But where they, you know, often needed help was in how to sell wine. Because at the end of the day, even if you're selling a can, and even if you have a great business case to present, there's still something a little scary and intimidating about selling wine. And so that has actually been one of the biggest hurdles, is how to make them comfortable talking about it.
And how do you make them comfortable talking about it?
Well, I try to pitch them and educate them as I do the end consumer, which is to make our can really straightforward, in the sense that our can is everything you want to know about our product. It's got the varietal, it's got the region that it's sourced from, it's got our people, places, and practices behind the wine listed on the back, and it also has our ingredients. So I always say, look, like, you don't have to be a sommelier to sell our wine. Just lean on the information we already have here, and frankly, just have them taste it. Have it taste test against, you know, bottled wines in that, you know, $15 to $25 price point, and you'll be good to go.
Okay, so the ingredients is very interesting. So there's a big push. I mean, you probably know in Europe now we have ingredient labeling. There's a big push inside the United States to do this, but there's a big push back from people not wanting to do it. Now that you've got the ingredients, have you had any consumer feedback? Do consumers care about it?
Totally. I get so much consumer feedback. I get this is like one of the reasons why I love this brand. Right. Yeah. So, and a lot of this, I think, has to do with, you know, we've gone through a journey, right, to kind of connect with the American consumer. We built wine up to be kind of this impenetrable sort of scary thing. And then at the same time, we also have these mass produced wines that are, as you mentioned, full of sugar and food coloring and all these other things. And people want to know that. People want to know that because also their tastes are changing. And they just want to be, this is like a pretty big investment when you think about it compared to other alcohol. And they want to know that they're going to like what they're going to get. So I'm all for it.
Yeah, no, it's okay. So let's talk about the wine itself. Where did you go? How did you source it? What was your first wine? Tell me the wine part of the journey.
Yeah. Oh, this is like my favorite thing to talk about. So, in the beginning, it was okay. What we really want to do is we want to find a really delicious wine. We want to be able to tell this whole story. And so it started with, I was working full time at the time. So I didn't just come up with this idea and quit my job, right? I knew enough to be scared of getting into the wine industry. So I knew I needed to, I wanted to build out a global portfolio because I also had this hunch that just like baby boomers really built the domestic wine industry, millennials and Gen Zers and Gen Xers were increasingly interested in international wine. So I needed to partner with countries that were on a similar time zone just because I was working a full, you know, a day job that was pretty intense. And so I reached out. I started with Chile because I had traveled there personally and I had loved drinking their wine. And the first wine that we sourced from them was a Sauvignon Blanc from Casablanca, which mm-hmm. I'd always believed was one of the most underrated but truly fabulous white wine regions in the world. And I did a ton of research on my desktop of like, who were the young winemakers down there that were making a splash? And I basically found about 6 or 7 names, reached out to them. Of those 7, I think 5 told me to F off. And one was like, okay, I'll meet with you. And the other one was like, I totally get what you're trying to do. So my husband then fiance at the time, and I flew down to Chile and we met with them. And then we just drove around to a bunch of different vineyards and tasted different grapes and tasted different vintages and talked about what we wanted to make. But the moment we met Luca Hodgkinson, who was our first winemaker, who we still work with today, I was like, absolutely, you're my partner who I want in Chile. And it really built the foundation for us that has evolved around our operating model, which is find someone on the ground, you know, work directly with them to leveraging their connections and relationships to identify the vineyards you want to work with, then produce the wine renting capacity from existing wineries within usually like 15, 20 minutes of where the grapes are harvested. Then we, you know, make all the wine there, ship it to the United States for co-packing. And the only thing that's really evolved over that process as we've grown is actually as we've researched about packaging and canning and how we have to approach canning wine different than bottling wine, our involvement kind of gets earlier and earlier. So, man, we can't just have SOPs around canning wine. We have to have SOPs around the grapes that we use to make the wine.
Yeah, so this is a whole lot of issues because so many brands that try and democratize wine or whatever are actually simply bulk wine that's been, but you're not talking about that at all. You're talking about for real. Okay. So canning does present problems. And one of the things that's held it back is that sometimes you can get off, you know, hydrogen sulfide and all sorts of things. So how did you solve that problem?
Yeah. I mean, this kept me up at night for a really long time. So first can we just take a step back and talk a little bit about why the can? So, because this is kind of really important as to then how we went about solving this. I felt pretty strongly that cans were a great option for wine, mostly because of what they've done for beer and RTEs. And what have they done? They, one, allowed for a ready-to-drink option that was a moderate serving size. The second piece is that, especially in beer's case, because it's hermetically sealed, it allowed for a fresher experience, which is really important when you think about how, I think it's something like 95% of all wine that's bought and sold in this country is consumed 72 hours after purchase, and it's less than 2 years old. So we're drinking younger, fresher wines as a whole. So how do we optimize for that? And then the third piece is that aluminum is recyclable everywhere in the United States, thanks to Coke and Pepsi. So you don't have the problems that you face in glass or even some Tetra Pak where it's not recyclable everywhere. It truly is a more sustainable solution.
Yes. In fact, this is a really important point. Somebody from the aluminium group here in Europe told me that 70% of all aluminium that's ever been mined is recycled. And even if it goes into the incinerator, they can still Correct. Take it out at the end and recycle it. It's a very recyclable material.
Very. And the 70% has been in circulation since the 1950s. So we are continuously reusing this. And so then it comes to the question of, okay, now how do I really optimize for this? Well, any brewer, will tell you that they approach making beer for a bottle different than they will for a can. Mm-hmm. So first it's understanding that process, right? Okay, suddenly I have to think about things like dissolved oxygen, and I have to think about things like, you know, level of sulfur. But the really, as we were experimenting with this from the get-go, so we did our first canning. We also experienced those off aromas. We tried to control for as much as possible, but the shelf life wasn't really there. At around 9 months, we started experiencing these off aromas. So we reached out to the University of Cornell and to an artist, and from the get-go, we just said, let's start testing these wines and figuring out what's going on, because I know that we want to change things, and I do believe that this should be part of the solution, but we can't be so arrogant as to think that it immediately, once we adapt it, we decided to be so that it'll be a perfect replacement pour. So we started literally over multiple fillings, because part of our model was that we were canning every 6 to 8 weeks rather than once a year. So we could literally study what were the different things that the different steps that we were taking. The other thing that we did was we started testing the liners of all of the big, you know, can manufacturers. And we started recognizing that it's not just about the liner itself, it's about the consistency of the application of the liner. And there were some companies that put more of a priority on that than others. And that really guided which canning companies we worked with. And we ended up commissioning studies with the University of Cornell, one which just won a major award. Really what they're focusing on there was the role that sulfur and sulfites play in these off aromas. And the fact that, to put it in kind of layman's terms, when you bottle wine, it's quite forgiving. You know, the whole point of it is that you're having discrete amounts of oxygen in through a cork. When you can, it has to almost be perfect. Like, it has to be perfectly ready to serve exactly as you want it. So you have to control things like dissolved oxygen and all of these other pieces really down to a T, and make sure that you've dialed it in perfectly before you can it. And when you do, the can's a great format for preserving the integrity of that experience for longer than a bottle would be. But you have to make sure that you know what you're looking for. And part of why we not only did that study and have adopted that into our own SOPs, but we've made this study available to everybody.
Oh, great.
It's because we recognize that we have to build a category.
Well, also you have a waste problem if, you know, it's not sustainable if some of the batch – I mean, you know, one of the worst things I ever saw in my life was seeing a dump full of unsold wine bottles. It's a hideous thing. Oh, that's great. So when you decide to – so you started with the Sauvignon Blanc. When you began to add other how did you do it? What was it driven by? Was it driven by availability, or what was a plane ride away, or how did you build a portfolio?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, you know, look, I think that one of the dangers of the wine business is that we are a constant self-fulfilling prophecy. Like, we all look at what does Nielsen data say is like the top selling wines, and then we rush to build a portfolio that looks like that. And there's some truth in it, but I think we always have to double click on who's driving the growth, what's the style. So that's a big piece of what we do. We started conducting our own research. Some of it was like through what resources were currently available. Some of it was running like literally test groups with people across the country who were in our target consumer group. And what we found was that, you know, at the time also rosé was really hot. So we knew we had to have a Provençal rosé that Pinot Grigio, people were really looking for. There was Sauvignon Blanc, we knew was going to be a monster, and it's continued to grow just healthy, double, even triple digits year over year. But that Pinot Grigio over Chardonnay was actually where most young people's interest lied. There was Chardonnay actually had a lot of baggage among 20 and 30 year olds. And so we really kind of honed in on that, and we asked ourselves constantly, so what were the varietals that we felt like were trending and that there was still a big enough market to fulfill this sort of national strategy we had? What was the style that we really needed to hone in on? And we used AI, even things like AI, as much as possible. We tried not to just rely on our own taste buds, but like get as much data as we could to...
When you say used AI, in what way?
Well, there are companies now that literally have... Yeah, like Tastery, exactly. Okay. That have like broken down chemical components of wine and are, and I think, again, because wine industry, our gatekeepers often are really being quite subjective in what they decide is good and not, which, again, has created a lack of inclusivity, I would argue. So really thinking more about who our consumer is, what are the gaps in market that we're trying to fill, making sure that we're taking them on a tour of the wine world. So we're going to well-known wine regions that have these great stories. And then in brass tacks terms, Felicity, like I was really dedicated to like building out a sustainable portfolio that was made from organic grapes, that would follow our SOPs, that would partner me in this way. And so I was kind of limited by price, the American market is very expensive. The more low intervention that you try to go. And so that really pushed me to Europe and other countries. And then of course it's personality. So like, you know, now when we approach people, they're much more excited because we've done a good job, I think, of demonstrating that there's a market for this. But in the beginning, it was tough. There was a lot of people like taking a chance on us, particularly because we wanted their names on the back of our cans. We wanted people to know that it was a real winemaker.
Let's talk about money. One of the most difficult things for any company is actually at the point of growth. It's the point of success. That's when you need to really ramp up production, but it's going to be a while before you get paid. So how did you fund all of this? What was your first investment?
Well, the first investment was basically the money we were going to use for my MBA. So my husband had saved some money to go to school and he was lucky enough to get a scholarship. And then when he graduated, it was my turn to go to school. But instead I convinced him that I wanted to build this instead. So we were the first money in the door. This was my business degree. And then, you know, it's really hard, obviously. I don't really begrudge anybody who didn't write me a check back then because I wasn't from the industry. And, you know, I'm a woman in this industry and those were kind of too big.
Whereas I begrudge every single person who hasn't written me a check.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've had a lot of therapy, Felicity. I've had a lot of therapy. But, you know, it was really hard.
Did you seek investment and get turned down? And if so, on what basis did they turn you down?
Well, that could be its own podcast, Felicity.
This is really, really interesting. Is it that people didn't understand the wine industry, or is it that there's not enough financial data because Simon, it's family companies, which is a problem in Europe, or is it just that wine is just a terrible investment? Did you get any feedback about why people wouldn't do it?
Yes, I got a lot of feedback. So just focusing on the business plan, I would say that the feedback I got was, lack of proof of concept. that people would even drink canned wine. That was one initial. Like, oh my god, it was a lot of thinking about who's writing a check, right? If you're interested in wine and you had the money, you're probably a wine collector with your own cellar. And the idea of just canned wine was so hard to overcome initially. Because you were like, well, I would never want my 20-year-old Bordeaux in a can. And I was like, well, that's not the wine we're talking about canning. I'm never coming after those 20-year-old Bordeaux in a can and trying to put them in a can. Those should always be in glass bottles. This is just for the wine that we're drinking immediately. Some of it was, I think there's a confusion between building a wine brand and building a winery. Right. So, you know, in this case, it was really demonstrating the scope of the opportunity. And the pushback I really got was, show me it's scalable, show me that people actually want it. So it was a lot of very piecemeal, you know, small checks of, I definitely want to give credit where credit's due, for there were a few people that really believed in me early on, enough to kind of keep us going. And then we convinced JetBlue to bring us on board. And when that happened, that was like a pretty big game changer for our company.
JetBlue. Now, everything was going well, and then the pandemic happened. Something happened with JetBlue that's ringing something in my head.
Well, yes. Yeah. So I learned that JetBlue was going to bring us on in June of 2019. It was just supposed to be a test that launched in January of 2020. I thought I had it made. And then, you know, 2.5 months later, the whole world shut down. And, you know, I mean, our company had been built in the on-premise. We were taken off in the travel industry. I gave birth to a baby on March 17th of 2020. So I had a newborn and I had to figure out how we were going to navigate our way through the pandemic. But which we figured it out and we nursed that partnership through the pandemic.
Well, hang on. Tell me what you did. Don't leave me hanging.
Oh, well, I mean, what did we do? Well, we really shifted hard into takeout. So we worked a lot with our biggest restaurant partners. And we said, we're going to learn how to do Toast. We're going to learn how to do Uber Eats and DoorDash and figure out how to be the pop-up so that you can add us. You know, this is where canned wine's really an edge. Increase your basket size because you can add a glass of wine to your order. We launched a D2C business and we pivoted really hard into grocery. As hard and as fast as we could. And we brought on Elizabeth Banks during that period of time because she had a break from filming. She was spending a lot of time with her family in Utah. And as I was thinking, man, I have no money to market and build a D2C business. I have to find, like, I need to figure out how to really get the word out. This is the time for the big idea. And in the back of my head, I'd always thought that she would make a great spokesperson and partner for the brand because she kind of is Archer Ruse. She's cheeky, she's irreverent, but she's also smart and sophisticated and sexy and fabulous. And so I reached out to her and sent her a case and I get a phone call from her floating down a river in Utah. And she's like, I get it, man. Like, sign me up. I am all for, you know, building. I love projects where I can entertain people and I want to bring people together. So it's kind of a mass audience type of thing. And this is kind of what you're trying to do as well. And, you know, I want to build something that the person sitting next to me on the soccer field would be like, yeah, I want to bum a canned wine off of you while we watch my kids' soccer practice.
Okay, so why that particular celebrity? I mean, I'm sure you watched The Hunger Games and thought, yeah, great. But did you research her and go, actually, she's really funny and cool and she's right for my audience?
I'd been a fan. So it wasn't just The Hunger Games, right? It was like Wet Hot American Summer. It was Pitch Perfect. It was
so. It really was an act of love. It wasn't. It wasn't a sort of cynical business plan to get her in. You actually.
Well, I'm a business person, so like, of course, it also made sense. I was looking for somebody who was funny. I was looking for somebody who'd be a creative partner. I was looking for someone who had their own social media platform, which in the pandemic was super important. And then we, you know, built a deal where she could really have input in the company and she could be a co-owner, invest in success. I wasn't paying her, you know, just just to attach her name on it. It was really like we were in this together. And she's been a fabulous partner because of it.
I mean, that's a huge act of trust to talk to somebody, especially over Zoom in the pandemic, and then go come on board as a partner. Was it instant chemistry? What was it that made you go, yes, I'm gonna go into business with this person I've met over Zoom, presumably?
Well, I mean, we had multiple conversations, but yeah, I mean, it was a massive act of trust. Huge. There was just kind of a few things that like was also like these weird overlaps. Like she's from Massachusetts. I live in Massachusetts. You know, she's got two boys. At the time, you know, I was a boy mom. We both weirdly had Bernedoodles. We loved to ski. We were smart women who felt like we had kind of always been underestimated. And we both loved the same kind of wines. We both thought of wine the same way. And for us, this was really about building something that was fun and approachable and about connecting with other people. And we really got that. And then when I kind of described the character of Archer Roos, of like this sort of boundary pushing, risk taking adventurer and kind of create an explorer who was whimsical and irreverent, she got that entirely. And in fact, had written her thesis around a similar character in college. And so it was just kind of this weird kismet thing that made it feel like this was going to work.
And how did having her on board change the trajectory of the company?
I mean, this is where I like want to say unequivocally to everybody who's listening, the world is sick of celebrity brands, right? Like nobody cares about celebrity brands. You have to build things that are authentic and that really resonate with people's audiences. And then if you are lucky enough to have somebody of Elizabeth's caliber be involved in your project, then it's really about voice amplification. But the brand itself cannot be celebrity. And this is what is so distinct about our partnership. Like, you know, we are a company that's about, you know, bringing a better glass of wine to consumers that increases transparency in the industry and that brings it to you in a format that fits your lifestyle. And like, that's what our brand is, that's what our product is. And our brand is about doing it in a fun and approachable way and meeting you where you are in your life. And for having someone like Elizabeth involved, because I kind of think of her as like the cool big sister, she's just helping us deliver that message. And I think that's what makes great partnerships in this space. And that's what we all need to be thoughtful about as we build them.
I just want to go back to what you said about you leaned into grocery. How difficult did you find it to get into retail? And once you were there, I mean, as I understand, it's a very expensive proposition. How did you manage that as a growing company?
Okay, well, there's kind of two things that I want to note. One is that we give a lot of crap to the three-tiered system here in the United States, but we also have to acknowledge that the big difference between for the grocery channel in the U.S. versus Europe is actually that the three-tiered system kind of helps us and protects our margins. Because, you know, we're not being leaned on by retailers in the same way. And so it's a contrarian view, but I think this is always about understanding, being a pragmatist and recognizing what's the world that we're operating within and then how do I build a budget accordingly. And so, it is very expensive, but you have to understand what can you really compete on. And for us, it's not about doing BOGOs. It's, you know, buy one, get one for free, which a lot of retailers or brands use to kind of introduce their brand. For us, it was big investments in liquid to lip samplings and in experiences and events. And it was really about leaning into stores that were near our stadiums and other big tent pole placements we had that we could then drive people to using things like geo-targeting for social. Okay. And that's really the biggest kind of piece of advice I have for people outside the box. Listening to this is to think outside the box a little bit. In terms of, yes, there's what you have to do to drive conversion in store, but you just have to think, where is the arbitrage and what other value adds can you offer the retailer? And I think that's what we did.
Okay. And you're also in Bag and Box and in Magnum. So first of all, what made you decide to go into Magnums and then tell me about Bag and Box?
Well, we were in Bagnums.
Bagnums. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. And so you're not in Magnums, you're in Bagnums.
Bagnums.
Okay, because I thought Magnums was a bit strange.
Yeah. So a little bit about our history. We actually launched as a boxed wine company, and we launched the cans a year later because we were selling a $35 box, and that was really hard in an environment where people were spending like $22 to buy Boda Box. So we actually launched the cans as a smaller serving size to like taste people on the wine before they committed to the box. And we actually just found that the application for the can was just so much bigger. I'm a huge fan of boxed wine, and I love that boxed wine seems to be having a moment here in the States. We have a lot of high-end entrants, which I think is fascinating and amazing. And like, I want to link arms with all of these brands and like figure out how we can build this category together. But a lot of this just comes down to occasions. Like this is again where I think beer nails it. Like the beer doesn't think, oh, I just want to be in this instance at the romantic date for our consumers' lives. They think, how can I show up everywhere my consumer is? And that's how I approach formats in wine. It's let's get really smart about the wine that we are offering people. Let's make sure that we're thoughtful about how we treat that wine in different packaging. But then let's own all those various occasions. And that's what this is about.
Okay, so like I said, one of the most interesting things that happens in companies is when you go through rapid growth, because, you know, how are you going to supply? How are you going to scale up, especially with cans and, you know, canning facilities and stuff? Did you ever have a moment where you went, oh, how am I going to manage this?
I have it constantly.
And what constantly. Do you do?
When I had my first job in finance right out of college, I had an opportunity to meet with the company's CEO, and he gave me a great piece of advice that I'll never forget, which is chop the wood in front of you. Mm. And it's just about like, everybody is kind of working on really, really big problems all the time, right? But we just kind of have to focus on what is the absolutely crucial thing that I need to get done today, or like, how do we break it down into really small size pieces so it can truly be like a to-do list? And just focus on crossing off those individual things. So look, I worry about this stuff all the time. Like, growth is a great problem to have, but it's still a problem and it is stressful. Figuring out how you're going to pay for it, figuring out how your supply chain is going to keep up, figuring out how you're going to convince your business partners, aka distributors, to carry enough inventory so you're not chasing them for POs every 2 weeks. Like, these are all things you have to figure out. And half of it is relationships, which is frankly what this industry is all about. And the other piece is, you know, how do you figure out how to make the system work better for you?
Yeah. What have you learned about your customers in this? I mean, what do you know about the wine customer that you didn't know when you started?
Well, I mean, my customer has evolved because she's grown up. She's grown up. You know, she has kids now and a mortgage and a badass career. And like, I think one of the things I would say that my two biggest insights is that, one, wine is a treat. It is a treat, right? It's not a necessity like food that you necessarily like have to eat to survive. This is something that we do for ourselves because it makes us feel good. And so we need to talk to our consumer in a way that makes her feel good and makes her feel empowered. So we got to make her laugh and we got to edutain, but we also have to like make her feel empowered by choosing our product. And that's what helps her to navigate the challenges and different stages of life that we're in. The second piece is that like, as my original core consumer, you know, gets older and is now in her 30s, how do I think about cultivating that younger consumer? And there is a real pull. Like, most people will tell you, dumb yourself down, cheapen yourself to get that 21, 22-year-old. But the thing about being 21 and 22 is you're actually incredibly insecure because you haven't made a lot of the big decisions about your life yet. And so you're looking to that person who's 10 years ahead of you and saying, you know, do I want your life? And we're doing our job well if we make that Archer Ruse consumer look like she's got it all figured out so she can be that beacon of light to that person behind her. And then that's how we cultivate and grow that consumer, because we become aspirational in a different way.
Yeah, you know, you're talking about her. One of the most interesting things about wine is often perceived from the outside as being a male product, but actually young men are completely missing from the category. Do you try and appeal to young men, or you just keep it to young women?
Well, first of all, so there is a perception that if you build a brand for women, then you'll alienate men. And I'm here to tell you that 40% of my consumers on D2C are men. And they are, you know, boomer wine collectors that I hear from. And they are also 25-year-old guys. So that's like the first thing that I just want to stay up at the top. Mm. I did build this brand for women because women were the first fermenters. We have been, I think, ignored and overlooked by the industry. And yet more women than men, to your point, purport to being daily wine drinkers. Mm. But if you build a brand that is smart and fun and fundamentally based on a good product, then of course you'll appeal to men too, who are also smart and fun. And women make the bulk of the purchase decisions for their family by going to the grocery store or Instacart in my case. And so the product that ends up in their house, and as guys also get interested in wine, they'll experiment with it. And, you know, our packaging is really fun, but I don't think it's girly.
No, it's great. It's great packaging, actually. It's very sophisticated. It's simple. And it's not something that you would, you know, as a wine drinker, it's not something I'd think, better put it under the counter if somebody comes. So when you're adding a new SKU or a new wine, what drives the decision?
Well, first and foremost, consumer needs. So let me give you an example. When I started Archer Roos, one of the kind of cardinal rules as we think about portfolio expansion is that, like, it has to be a wine that'll be great in a can, meaning, mm-hmm. like, we're not looking for a super tannic wine that will age really well, right? Like, it's got to be ready to drink now. And, you know, I thought initially, like, oh, bubbles and whites and rosés, like, those styles will really be the only thing that consumers want. And so that's why our portfolio only has one red in it, despite, you know, red being just a huge juggernaut of a category. And what we've actually learned is that as our consumer sticks around and gets to know us, they're clamoring for red. Like, they want what we're offering, you know, in the rest of our portfolio in a red wine. You know, that's just like something that's really surprised me. And I think as our consumer evolves and as the category evolves, is something that we think a lot about.
When you say the consumer's clamoring, do you mean they send you emails?
They survey send me emails. We get requests from the, accounts that we work with. We get, emails directly from our D2C subscribers. And then we just keep track of it. And that is usually like the first thing that we reference. And then we say, okay, this is like, is this anecdotal or is this system wide? And then we start to like identify like, okay, how will we further refine that product? And then we start talking to like a couple of our tentpole partners and we see what the appetite is. And our rule is usually that we try to launch, we try to find a launch partner, to help us bring something to market so that we can test it in a really meaningful way before we scale it.
Have you ever tested something and gone, nope, that doesn't work, and killed it?
Yes.
You have? Okay. So we've touched on this, but just to summarize, the wine industry, as you probably know at the moment, is absolutely panicking. They're panicking about people drinking less, about public health warnings. They're worrying about people not ever taking up wine. But your company is growing at a exponential rate. What do you think you're doing differently, or what do you think other people should be doing that they're not doing?
I think I'm getting out of the echo chamber. Like, the wine industry has been having this conversation for the last 20 years and they've done nothing about it. So what I did was I just took what the data says and I went and I built a company that serviced it. I mean, I think the biggest thing here that what makes this industry so hard to change is structurally we're set up a certain way. Mm. And we do have to evolve. The consumer is drinking. but they want you to be consistent with their values. They're not going to downgrade. They are expecting you to come to their level. They have the internet. They're smart enough to know what they want and what they deserve. And they're also already have habits that now we have to fit into their lives. So this is just about recognizing that where we distribute, how we distribute, and what you distribute is going to change. And it's really up to you if you want to evolve with this consumer and recognize where this is going. And this is a message to distributors as well, because a lot of the authorizations that I've brought to them, they've been like, well, that's special accounts, because like that's not going to do enough volume to be worth it to us to even assign an account manager. And I've proven to them that that's not the case. So this is a recognition that there is a lot of wine to be drunk and a lot of money to be made if we listen to that end consumer and we let go our preconceived notions.
Okay, so you've conquered cinemas, you've conquered stadiums, you're about to conquer Taylor Swift. Where do you see the opportunity next? And are you going to export?
Oh man, I mean, I think with the right partner, we'd love to export. But where do we go next? There's so much. Like, there's so much within cinemas, within stadiums we haven't touched. What's next is mountains. We're really excited to be partnering with the Vail Group so that we can join Après Ski Life. Have a really good can of Malbec with your chili on a mountain. There's still so much that we have to do. And I'll tell you this, Felicity, like, I'm not going to be satisfied until I own my consumer's glass of wine between Sunday and Thursday night. Like, open that fabulous bottle on a Saturday with your friends, but when you're just pouring a glass of wine for yourself, like, I want you to reach for a Cheroux because you know that I care about you and I care about making sure you have a great experience and that we're going to give you some really fun options to choose from.
Well, on that very optimistic note, Marion, thank you so much for giving me all your insights.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome. Thank you.